Committee on Finance and Revenue is open. Good morning, everyone. I apologize for being a bit late. We're going to go in reverse order of the agenda today and start off with a public hearing on Senate Bill 391. Christine is here with a briefing, and Senator Farioli is on deck, ready to come up.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 391 would reallocate any personal income tax revenues that are attributable to government employees. It would reallocate those from the state general fund to the county. And this would apply to counties in which more than 50% of the land base is government-owned, or where more than 50% of the employment is in the government sector. It looks like a lot of the counties, especially in southeastern Oregon, are definitely greater than 50% in BLM, mostly in federal lands. So currently all personal income tax revenue is deposited into the state general fund, and this measure would change that allocation for certain taxpayers.
Okay, and from the Revenue Chairmanship Hall of Fame, we have Senator Farioli. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. For the record, Senator Ted Farioli, District 30. And as I was preparing my testimony this morning, rereading Senate Bill 391, which I haven't looked at since it was an LC, this is brilliant. This is good. This is really good work here. One of our time-honored mechanisms for redirecting dollars to local communities is tax increment financing. Tax over here and create a loop and put those dollars back into the investment for infrastructure or physical plant so that we have a leveraging point to create employment. This is sort of a variation on that theme. Basically, a whole bunch of eastern Oregon counties where we used to have very active forest products industry, we don't anymore because of our heroic effort to restore salmon and operate that land base in accordance with the Endangered Species Act and a myriad of other environmental issues. And also, those same enactments have a depressing effect on grazing because we have to increase buffer zones and make sure that water quality is the top concern. So when you look at the last couple of decades, we're losing population. And we're not able to sustain community services like public safety in the special districts like hospitals and fire and law enforcement. One of the ways that we could assist is to turn what local communities look at as potentially not necessarily a liability, because a job is a job in eastern Oregon, but really turn it into an economic engine. And that would be if we could capture the income taxes paid by folks who are working for the federal, state, local, and municipal governments and just redirect those back to the local government as tax revenue. So instead of taking it into the revenue system at large in the general fund and then reallocating back to dozens of programs that help, we would shorten that loop, and it would just be a calculation. Add up the tax dollars from the federal land base, from the counties, from the cities, from the special district employees, calculate that number, and return that to the local jurisdictions. That would really give local jurisdictions a shot in the arm. They could use that money to invest in infrastructure that would create opportunities for the next thing, which at this point in time, there's so few dollars available for infrastructure development and investing in new technologies. I can think of a project in John Day, Oregon, where we are trying to get a high-speed internet loop from Seneca to John Day to Prairie City, which would complete a ring so that high-speed internet would be available at houses, you know, at very high rates, so that we could have entrepreneurial development there. When we look around for the opportunity to finance those kind of projects, we're in competition with the rest of Oregon at large for dollars, and those projects can't be justified on a purely population base. You know, there's only 7,500 people living in Grant County. So, you know, on all the different competitive indices that we use, those local governments find themselves kind of on a tin cup basis. If they get anything, it's only because somebody leveraged it. So this would allow those local governments to sort of be sustained and supported by the changing workforce that moved most of the jobs out of the private sector and out of the communities, leaving a preponderance of the workforce employed by the public sector. So it's a nice little feedback loop. I commend it to your wisdom. I think it would really help in Southeast Oregon and in Eastern Oregon, where the population fits the category we've described and where the employment base is mostly federal and state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. It is an interesting idea. And
brilliant, actually, Mr. Chair. I do think so myself.
Well, no, I mean, we need to look at out-of-the-box thinking as well as anything else that's not working right now. Any questions, Senator David?
Perhaps it's in the bill. I was just trying to pull it up. Because which counties would this include?
Beg your pardon, ma'am?
Which counties?
You know, I don't have a survey of the counties, but we tried to be a little bit circumspect in the number of counties.
Oh, right there. He's
getting him. You're getting a map right in front of you.
Yikes. Okay, so imagine you're looking at a spreadsheet, ma'am. This is where the red ink is.
Okay.
So it's most of the southern tier.
Now I'm just curious about the idea. And follow up, please.
Sure.
Thank you, Senator Hess. So what is the expected revenue that it would generate?
That, ma'am, would require a ways and means analysis.
Oh, she hasn't done that. Okay. All right. I was just curious.
Yeah. I don't think that we're going to retire and move to the Bahamas on this. But I will tell you the red ink shows those counties that have at least half of their land managed by federal agencies. The dark red is 60% plus. And some of these counties are over 70% federal management. And notice I don't say federal ownership, I say federal management. The ownership is vested in all Americans. And the temporary custodian happens to be different federal agencies. But this was Oregon land before it was federal land. So we need to help these communities. If you look at the unemployment rate and overlay that map on this map, you'll find a really close correlation with the high unemployment and high federal ownership. So it's a way to help.
Senator Boquist?
No. I think Gil's going to come up. I have a question for Gil.
Okay, thank you, Senator Ferguson.
And I appreciate the Deus Ex Machina map. That was, you know, the finger of God produced this map in the form of Mr. Redette. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Have a great day.
Thank you. I don't believe we have anyone signed up to testify on this, so we will close a public hearing on Senate Bill 391, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 787. And that is Kyle for a briefing, and Senator Cruz is here. He is the sponsor of that bill, so he's been here, so go ahead, Kyle.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 787, it requires the tax collector of a county that's listed as being at higher risk of financial distress to withhold from property tax collection distribution an amount equal to the county's actual property tax assessment and collection costs after accounting for the funds that are received from the County Assessment Function Funding Assistant Account, or CAFA account, and amounts levied by taxing districts that are for to pay bonded indebtedness. It does limit the withheld assessment and collection costs to no more than 2% of the taxing district's distribution unrelated to the bond. It does apply to property tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2018. And then just for a little point of reference, I did include the Oregon Secretary of State Audits Division most recent audit of the county governing practices and such. That is in the meeting materials. And according to the division's 2016 reports, that's the most recent one that came out, the four counties that are listed as being at a higher risk of financial distress are Curry, Douglas, Josephine, and Polk counties.
Okay, Senator Cruz, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Senator Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1, and three of the counties just listed are counties I represent. Kind of a follow-up on Senator Farioli. About a decade ago, we took leadership in this building on a tour of the timber distressed counties, and everybody showed a great deal of concern and then subsequently forgot all about the fact that we had been on a tour. This isn't a silver bullet that's going to solve all problems. It's not designed to do that. What it's designed to do is help in an incremental way, and that's basically to allow four counties, if they choose to, ability to recoup some of the costs of collecting taxes for the taxing districts within the counties. I mean, for example, Douglas County has 129 taxing districts when you count them all together, and it does cost the county some money to do the collection, do the assessment, and do the distribution. And like I said, there's only four counties that would be impacted by this at this point in time, and it's just quite simply a way to kind of forestall what may be inevitable for some of these counties as it is. I would suggest the county in the greatest distress right now is Curry County, and Josephine is not far behind. And by distress, I mean they don't have any money. You know, what we're seeing is a lack of law enforcement in these counties because they can't afford to hire deputies. And that's specifically true in Josephine County, which becomes really problematic in that part of the state because that's where the drug cartels are the strongest, and we don't have law enforcement as a counterbalance. Not that we could ever match them for resources because the cartels are very rich. But this is quite simply an attempt to forestall a little bit what may be inevitable. And Douglas County is a prime example. Douglas County has done a very good job of managing their reserves, but at this point in time, the track we're going down, they'll be out of reserves in 2 years. Okay, then the question becomes what services are going to be provided. Now, the worst case scenario is all of these things revert back to the state because most of the functions of county government are a shared service model where the state contributes some money and the counties contribute some money, and I'm talking about assessments, tax collection, elections, a whole long laundry list that are shared services. Counties, quite honestly, are only required to do a couple things. They have to have a sheriff, a jail, and they have to serve papers. That's basically it. Everything else is in agreements with state government as to how those services are delivered. Now, quite honestly, we don't want to see those reverting back to a centralized form. We think it works very good at the county level. And so, like I said, this isn't a silver bullet, but I think it's a way that's going to help a couple of these counties, and it is very limited, and it's limited by the report from Secretary of State. So there's no games being played with this. These are just the counties that could be affected. So I think it's worth some consideration as a little step, a little something we can do to help those counties survive maybe a little bit longer.
I appreciate that. I like Senator Farioli throwing some ideas on the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In 2007, I accompanied Speaker Merkley on that timber tour.
Yeah.
And I guarantee you I haven't forgotten it. I remember very, very vividly one meeting we had, I believe it was in Josephine County, where the sheriff was talking about the fact that he could not handle the patrol, and he was worried about the upcoming motorcycle gangs coming in because they do their annual meeting there. And we had one local citizen who said very clearly, I don't need any more sheriffs. I have a gun and a backhoe. That worried me a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very concerned about the county, those timber counties, because they're really hurting, and I understand that, and I know it. But when the citizens themselves in those counties don't want to step up at all, and you know that's true, then it's really difficult for us to do something. And you know, we really need that the citizens to say to us, not just the representatives, but the citizens to say to us, yeah, we'll help, but we need help.
Well, Senator Riley, I'm glad you remember the tour. It was eye-opening for a lot of us.
It was.
But I would suggest that these counties we're talking about, where 60% of the land we cannot collect anything from, and you're also talking about counties that, generally speaking, have 20% unemployment. So, you know, you increase the property tax rate, it isn't going to solve the problem. I know we look at that, but the fact is that let's take Curry County, for example. Curry County has the highest percent of retired people in their county of any county in the state.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Curry County has tried for tax measures. It's awfully hard to get people on fixed income to want to pay more in taxes. That's completely understandable. But even if we raised the property taxes, it isn't going to solve the problem, because there's such a small portion of the land base that is taxable.
Follow up, Mr. Chair? I absolutely agree. That won't solve the problem. And we need to help. I fully agree with you, but that we need to help those counties because they're in real trouble. But I do have a problem when we make those tours and the citizens come in and say, I don't care, I don't need your help. That bothers me.
Well, there's always going to be people like that, okay?
All right, thank you.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Chairman Hass. A couple of observations, and then get Senator Cruz's comments, and then I want to ensure staff, regardless of what we do, then issue or puts in the issues discussed, several items that I want to make sure are in the record in writing. The proposal, I think, that I'm looking at here from Senator Cruz is, of course, based on the Secretary of State's annual report, which
yes.
is a good benchmark to understand the auditing of county financial records, which is different from a county in distress. And that's what I want to really hone in on here, is that when you go into Curry, Douglas, and Josephine and you look at the audited financial statements first, you can see that there are structural financial problems within those counties. Interesting enough, we'll go to the opposite end of the fourth one that would be eligible for this. It has its county audited financial statements raise the eyebrow too, and that's Polk County, which is one of my counties, but it has in fact increased taxes.
Mm-hmm.
But it still has a audited financial statement that is challenging. Now, counties require three basic services, and Senator Cruz is right, and that's jail, sheriff, and serve papers. So there are other counties of the 19 former frontier counties. That's why I was hoping Gil at some point was going to come up here and we can go back in history, because we used to say these 19 frontier counties, which is a term we have in this committee, those are the ones that are really in financial distress, because it's pretty easy to pick, you know, we'll just say Humpty Dump County, so we don't pick something. Now, Humpty Dump County has a jail, one room, has a sheriff, one sheriff, And he can go out and serve papers, and so he can meet the functional responsibilities, and they're, quote, not in financial distress, but they don't have any roads, and they don't have any of the other shared services that are out there, and in fact, they are in more distress than any of the other ones that are on an audited financial statement, because their audit looks pretty good, because they have enough money to pay the sheriff, for him to drive his four-wheel drive out and serve the papers, and to turn the light switch on in one run-room county jail that they don't use anyway, because there's only 600 or 800 residents in the county. And so what I want to ensure we focused it on this and then get Senator Cruz is that this is a mechanism that addresses only four of the counties of probably 7 to 10 more that are frankly in some cases in much worse day-to-day fiscal distress just because they made their audit statements look good because they cut all those services down to the jail, the sheriff, and the served papers.
Now, Mr. Chair, I would agree with Senator Boquist. We used the Secretary of State's report because it is something that's solid, and it's a third-party report, and we also checked with the new Secretary of State, and these reports will be ongoing as well. This isn't something he's dropping. So that was the benchmark we chose to use because it's something solid. You know, Senator Boquist makes a very good point. If there's another benchmark that would work, I would have no problem with that. We just chose one that was clear and distinct. Okay. Thank
you. Senator Cruz, thank you for bringing this to this committee.
Thank you.
We will see you later today. And from the wild frontier, let's have Gil Riddell ride up here.
I'm having my gun holstered back at the office,
yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Frontier County.
Now you have to check it when you come into Salem. Isn't that disgusting?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gil Riddell, Policy Director, Association of Oregon Counties. Thank you very much for scheduling these two bills. I will, with the chair's permission, in summary fashion, explain the reasons for the all-too-common county fiscal distress that you've heard about and that actually exists, and in the process discuss some of the shortcomings of the CAFA program, the unrealized potential. And I believe both these subjects will be relevant to your work on state revenue reform. I posted all my materials on OLIS. They're before you. And if you would please look at this memo, first look at the memo that's titled, Why Are So Many Counties in Fiscal Distress? I point out that several counties have a county permanent tax rate authority that is too low. I list 13 of them as examples, and Josephine at 58 cents, maybe 59 cents, Curry at almost 60 cents, and so on. Contrast that with the average mean tax rate imposed by counties that was imposed also by cities and school districts in this last fiscal year, and you see from the DOR records, $2.82 a tax rate, mean tax rate for counties, cities $5.44, and K-12 ESD $6.92. County local property tax administration is the engine for producing revenues for public services of all these local taxing districts, yet the percentage of collections retained by county for county services, including county administration of property taxes, is often inadequate. I give you six examples. this is the portion of the total collections that are retained by the counties, and some of these are really quite small. As you see, the statewide mean is 17% compared to schools, 41%, and cities, 21%. The memo refers to a second memo that's posted that is titled Brief History of Direct Property Tax Cost Sharing. It's four pages. It's up to the present day. I simply want to highlight a couple of points on that, if I may. The county assessment function funding assistance account was born of necessity. In 1989, we had a property tax system that was disintegrating because of the 80s recession and the end of federal revenue sharing, and counties across the board cut so their staff. So the assessors lost the field presence, appraisal presence in the field. Things were really out of whack. stakeholders and the legislature created the CAFA program. As it stands today, CAFA is funded by an increase in the percentage of interest on delinquent property taxes from 12 to 16%, with that 4% increment going directly to CAFA. Now, I hasten to add that 36 of the 50 states have interest rate on underpayment of property tax that's higher than the interest rate on refunds. So Oregon is not unusual in that regard. In addition, 25% of the cities and special districts, 25% of the first 12% of the interest on delinquent taxes that would have gone to cities and special districts were directed to CAFA, to fund CAFA. There's an assessor processing fee of 10% per document filed with the county clerk, and an additional $1 fee that goes to the Land Information System Fund for DOR. Now, counties are required to have their A&T budget approved by DOR as in compliance with certain statutory requirements, typically relate to equity and uniformity. A county that's out of compliance not only does not receive its CAFA grant, but is subject to reductions in non-dedicated state shared revenues. There's an education, continuing education requirement imposed on appraisers and assessors under the program, and local governments are permanently preempted from imposing new real estate transfer taxes or fees. CAFA has paid out 90% to counties in proportion to their approved budgets and up to 10% to DOR for supervisory expenses and to pay for appraisals on industrial properties valued from $1 million to $5 million that used to be done by counties. Notice the contributions to the A&T system by cities and special districts. 25% of their delinquent interest is foregone. And for cities are preempted from any real estate transfer taxes and fees. Notice the contributions from schools. Nothing. They get 41% of the property taxes that are assessed and collected. In 1999, the legislature began appropriating $5 million with CPI per biennium to CAFA through the DOR budget. Counties interpreted these payments as on behalf of collection and assessment for the state-funded school program, and we appreciated them very much. CAFA was hoped to provide 35% of the costs of local A&T. In reality, that happened only in three fiscal years, 2002, 2003, 2004. CAFA has settled in now around 20% of the costs of local jurisdictions to collect taxes, property taxes. In 2009, the legislature ignored recommendations of the governor's task force on federal forest payments and county services to place all delinquent interest on property taxes into CAFA with a backfill from the state to K through 12. Instead, the legislature chose to sweep the remainder of the $5 million biennial appropriation to CAFA and halted any future appropriations to CAFA. We've not seen that since. Now, back to the discussion of county fiscal distress. The page 2 of the memo, several counties are forced by location to be dependent on federal forest management policy decisions and federal forest receipts or their substituted safety net payments, secure rural schools and the successors. The following figures and counties I've listed under that title are dated. The last time we did this was in fiscal year 2006, but they're still in proportion, and I think they're still telling. You see that if without safety net payments in that fiscal year, the general fund loss to Douglas County, for example, would have been 69%. The county mean through all these, I've listed 12 counties, the county mean would be 12%, would have been 12% that year. Road fund loss is even more stunning and includes different counties from the list above. the 15 counties, so there's 15 counties listed, and the county mean for road fund loss without safety net payments in 2006 would have been 28%. Federal forest safety nets have expired. They are no more. Please look at the bar chart. It's on OLIS. It shows you graphically. Without the safety net, national forest payments to county road funds based on actual harvest, because that's what we're getting now, for fiscal year 2012, which is $4.8 million, would have been 10% of the safety net payment that year to roads. Without the safety net, the ONC and Coos Bay Wagon Road payments, which are general funds to counties, they had been based on actual harvest in 2013, which is about $18 million, it would have been 48% of the safety net payments received by those counties that year. Why are federal payments so important? Well, it's a matter of location. If you look at this map from Department of State Lands, the white areas, which are in the minority, are the private lands. They're taxable. However, 97% of the white areas are under farm or forest deferral. The colored areas are not subject to property taxation. And then the map you saw from Senator Farioli gives you a breakdown of federal ownership by county, and of course, federal lands are not taxable. There are four statutes on the books now having to do with county fiscal distress. The first one that I mention here has to do with public safety emergencies, but please note that it's scheduled to sunset January 2nd, 2018. This is a procedure that involves the governor being notified of a potential distressful situation in a particular county or multiple counties, consulting with the legislature, making a proclamation, entering into an intergovernmental agreement. The state would bear 50% of the cost of services provided under the IGA. Counties would provide the other 50% by additional taxes imposed that would be imposed without a vote of the local citizens. And this would continue until terminated by either the governor or the legislature could terminate this at any time. This is on the books and is scheduled to sunset, as I say, in early 2018. There's one related to property tax services, which is more punitive than Senate Bill 787. Its standard is that the county has requested the governor to make a declaration that they cannot provide the minimally adequate property tax assessment and collection services. Department of Revenue comes in, does the work, and then is reimbursed from the CAFA funds to the county and the non-dedicated state shared revenues to the county. And then if there's more that is owed, they could go to the emergency board and ask. This is hardly a plus for an already distressed county. It's salt in the wounds. The third relates to county elections emergencies, and that is, again, county asks the governor to declare an emergency. Secretary of State provides the services until the emergency is passed, and then the county resumes conducting elections. And then finally, the governor has in the office a service delivery technical assistance program to provide technical assistance. There are three bills on this subject. Senate Bill 787 you have before you. There's also one that AOC has drafted, and it needs a little more work, House Bill 2086. It's about local government insolvency. House Bill 2627 is a public safety fiscal emergency bill. It would be declared by the county governing body, and the sheriff would be able to release prisoners from a county jail, move them to other counties or to Department of Correction facilities with the approval of the county, with the Department of Corrections. This clearly is a situation. We consider it an emergency. We consider CAFA to be, frankly, better than nothing, but has not lived up to its promise at all. There's not the cities and special districts have contributed mightily over time. where we spend our time collecting funds, plurality of which go to schools, and there's no contribution from them to help with that. The insolvency bill, we're working on that. We'll get it in shape so that the legislature can consider it and consider it seriously. Or you may wish to take the law that's now in the books that will sunset soon and maybe improve that and extend the sunset. So with that, I'm through, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions for Gil? Gil, thank you for that overview. Helpful. Wendy Johnson and Hasina Squires, please.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. And Hasina Squires had another appointment and had to leave. So Hasina is representing the special districts, and they're also opposed to the bill. The League is opposed to Senate Bill 787 because it shifts a county responsibility onto all the other taxing districts, namely cities, school districts, and special districts. We acknowledge the problem in the fiscally distressed areas and the need for more funds for property tax assessment and collections, but we don't believe this is the right bullet. It's missing the target altogether because it's just shifting our responsibility, and it doesn't actually address the real issue. I just want to go through the bill specifically and sort of point out where the issues are. In section 1, sub 2, it has the assessor and the tax collector deciding how much is needed to fund assessment and collection. And as Gil explained, usually the budget has to be approved by the Department of Revenue. And so this doesn't have that language of what the budget is. So that's a concern that they could create a different budget for this. And then in sub 5, it says that the money that would be withheld could go into a different account than the unsegregated tax collections account. So the way I read it is, even if you collect the money, it doesn't have to be used actually for assessment and collection, and that's a problem. We don't want it to be used for sheriff services or others. Our basic point is that this is a county function that the county should be paying for. So that's the first problem with it. Section 1, sub 4 also says that once you figured out the cost, you take out the bonds and the interest, and then also what would be normally going to CAFA, then you apportion it amongst all the taxing districts. That means, as I had said at the beginning, schools, cities, and special districts will be paying for what these costs. And so I've provided testimony that gives you, written testimony that gives you some examples. The city, let's see. Most of these cities have a taxing permanent rate that is higher than the county's, but the school district taxing rate is even much higher. So, for example, Myrtle Point, their permanent rate is $8, but the school district for Myrtle Point is $6.19. So those two districts would be paying the bulk of this tax because it would be apportioned the dollar from Coos County, $8 from the city from Myrtle Point, and then $6.19 from the school. That's how it would be shared. And that's just literally shifting that cost to a different taxing district. And all of these districts are in the same county. And it's the county that's chosen to have a permanent rate of $1.08, but to offer no local option levy and no, well, in this case, they do have a small bond of 27 cents, but they've chosen time and time again not to do a local option levy. And so we don't want to reward that same behavior and encourage it going forward that another taxing district would be paying for it. Another example would be Curry County, Brookings. That school district is paying $5.19. The city of Brookings is paying $3.76, and Curry County is 60 cents. So again, your basic over, I think 80, 90% of it would be going to a different taxing district to pay. And so that's our main concern with this, is if you just shifted it and you actually haven't made it be used for assessment and taxation. As Gil explained, cities and special districts already gave up part of their property tax revenues with the delinquency interest rates. That was part of the deal several years ago that we have foregone that revenue. And this would be another foregone revenue without any discussion with those involved. So we think what's necessary is a discussion about how to make sure this will work going forward, but we don't think this is the right choice. It's a local decision. It's property tax assessment, collection, elections, and the sheriff and the serving the papers are the key functions, and we believe it needs to stay there, and all you've done is shift it with this bill. So for those reasons, we would oppose the bill and ask that you look at it in a different way to fix the situation and acknowledge the problem, but this is not the solution. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Bilkins. Just an observation to correct you, Wendy. And I've looked at all of the numbers here and so on and so forth, and you're absolutely correct. This is just one little Band-Aid on a sucking chest wound at best. But the real issue that we have in a lot of these areas out there is something that cities have to help with. And you made mention that, you know, we don't want to reward bad behavior, which is absolutely correct. But generally speaking, in rural, in my district and most of rural Oregon, when you go look at the efforts to raise the taxing rate or do the bonding, as you pointed across there, the largest populations by far are in the cities. And we have a double-edged sword. We have the state under the law enforcement distress deal, where we're providing state troopers to backfill, and we've discussed that before, and you've heard me say this before. And so the locals don't want to vote for something that they already have. And then the second problem is the cities already have the services, and so, but they're part of the county, and they get to vote, so they vote against the county getting it too. And so we're in this death spiral going down. And I fully agree with you, but I just want to make sure that we understand that when you go to most of rural Oregon, the largest populations, no different than Multnomah County or the other counties, are in the urban areas. Now, I realize some people don't call Bandon and Myrtle Point urban areas, but they are cities in the population. So we need to be careful before we point the finger across the aisle and realize we all need to come together to find a solution. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. You know, to that point, I wasn't going to say anything, but the rural counties have a unique situation, but underlying that, the common denominator here that everyone wants to address is poverty. And rural Oregon does not have the corner on poverty. We need to address it, but Senator Riley and I come from arguably the most affluent county in the state, Washington County, where the Beaverton School District has more homeless students than any other school district, even bigger than Portland, where something just happened this week that I'm working on that is very bewildering, but there's a strip mall maybe a mile from my house. You know, it's your usual strip mall with a Safeway and a dry cleaners and a restaurant, and there's a Planet Fitness Center, and they're running a special where you can join the club for $15 a month, and that has got the attention of people have nowhere to go. And so homeless families in this population are essentially living in the parking lot of this strip mall or nearby and adjacent, and it's causing the kinds of issues that you might suspect with that. Neighbors who live around there are upset, and there's all kinds of issues there. And this is Washington County. This is in the shadows of Intel and Nike. And so in terms of raw numbers, Washington County probably has as many people in poverty, probably many more than Senator Cruz's district. Not as a percentage, but this is an issue that we all need to come together on, to echo my pal from Polk County. So on that cheery note, thank you for your testimony. And we will close out the public hearing on Senate Bill 787. Thanks, Kyle. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 150.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 150 modifies the minimum tax for C corporations. As you recall, since 2009, the minimum tax is a 12-tiered minimum ranging from $150 up to $100,000. This measure combines the first, the bottom two tiers, effectively reducing the minimum tax from $500 to $150 for corporations with sales between $500,000 and $1 million. So we go from a 12-tiered minimum tax to an 11-tiered minimum tax.
the policy rationale?
Yeah. And how many are there?
In that, as shown up there, there are roughly, there are 20,400 corporations that pay the minimum tax. About 1,900 of them had between 500,000 and a million in Oregon sales. There are also another 1,100 corporations that had sales in that range but paid tax subject to the rates. So just as a refresher, corporations determine their tax. They make all the usual complicated calculations to get down to taxable income. That income is applied to the tax rate structure, which is 6.6% and 7.6%. It's a two bracket structure. And then that number is compared to the minimum tax. So for corporations with Oregon sales between $500,000 and $1 million, they would make the normal calculation. And if that amount was greater than $500, they would be considered what we call a rate payer. If that calculation was less than $500, they'd have to pay the $500, and that's the minimum, because that's the minimum tax. And then that's what we refer to minimum payers. So in total, there are about 3,000 corporations with C corporations with Oregon sales between 500,000 and a million. Two-thirds of them pay the $500, and one-third of them pay more than $500. They pay the rate.
And we put in a bunch of these bills in the wake of Measure 97, I think, was how some of these came forward. So what can you fill us in on the practical applications or why, how this would work if we change plans or where we
are? Sure. I guess for context, for Measure 97, as I think everybody's aware, it significantly modified the minimum tax. And it actually moved most C corporations into the minimum tax. So when we were putting in the bills for this session, the outcome of Measure 97 hadn't been known. So there were a number of bills put in to potentially deal with whatever issues might come about if it passed or if it failed. And so it failed, and we have these bills to really just come back and double check and think about the minimum tax to see if the 12-tiered structure is really the best policy for a minimum tax. And there's nothing magical per se about combining the bottom two. The brackets are not indexed to inflation, so over time, that affects things. But that's a long-term impact.
Well, that's how the $10 stayed there for so long. It became ridiculed.
Exactly. The $10 was put in place in something like 1930, and it stayed $10 until 2009. And so we're trying to avoid that. By avoiding that, we can draft such bills so the discussion comes before the committee.
Just because it's stupid doesn't mean we can do it.
Do you know how much this would either gain or cost the general fund, the state?
Quick math. If we have 2,000 corporations, their minimum tax might be reduced by $350. So whatever that turns out.
Yep, got it. I can do
that. And not necessarily that much, because some corporations, when their rate tax might be $450. Mm-hmm. So then they go from paying $500 to $450. They'd actually switch from being a minimum taxpayer mm-hmm. to a rate payer.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So not every corporation would see a $150 reduction. It's weeds in the weeds.
So generally speaking, I mean, if we look at it right now, we have some of the corporations who are paying the minimum tax wouldn't even qualify for that minimum, would be lower, because there are many cases. It's back to the $10 argument. We just picked another number besides $10 and said, that's it, if you fall into this category. And it didn't mean whether they were making profit or they weren't making profit. It's just what we're going to charge that group. And I think the ramifications really of the bill, Mr. Chair, is if we look at structural overhaul, this isn't just another component you have to do. You must address that issue. If you wipe them all out, you do something else, you do a gross receipts tax, this is another one of those, you know, hydraulics that, you know, it's just not easy to say, hey, we're going to do X and now we're going to go do that. We have to change a whole bunch of statutory things we've created all the way back to the 30s in order to fix a process going forward. And the other thing that we, of course, don't know in regards to this is we've discussed it outside of this room, but the likelihood of the federal Congress and the new administration in the second reconciliation bill, somewhere in May and June, of doing tax overhaul, of which will we have positive and negative effects in wide swings on the state of Oregon, we need to take into consideration. And I think this is just a, my observation is this is not necessarily a good or bad bill. Actually, it's not necessarily a good bill, I'll just say that. It's just a mechanism that we have in place to look at and say, what do we do next?
Well, I think it's a good discussion, so it serves its purpose that way. I think most Oregonians or most people don't pay a lot of attention to this, assume that the corporate minimum is so that if you disguise your profit or whatever, you're still going to pay something just for sort of the privilege of using state highways, state roads, state services or whatever, a nominal fee. I think that's why the $10 was there, but something. But I don't think most people understand that it can go all the way up the scale, and that's where a lot of people I think come off in terms of understanding why you have corporate minimum up at those higher rates instead of just paying the rate you're assessed.
Right, it's kind of a backstop to the income tax rates, which are 6.6 and 7.6, and the minimum tax, while it's in dollar amounts, it can also be viewed as a rate. So we divide, whether it's the $150 all the way up to the $100,000, divided by the amount of sales at that level. So if you take the minimum tax and divide it by sales, and I did create a chart back when this was being discussed in 2009 that it shows that in a rate terms, it's a discontinuous graph where the rate can jump up to a tenth of a percent and then declines as sales decline, or as sales increase, and then it jumps back up to a tenth of a percent when you hit to a next bracket.
Well, we have about 40 states that are corporate income tax states. Is there a best practices or is there a preferred way to go or a more practical way to do corporate minimums?
I don't know that there's a preferred way. Different states do it differently. It really tries to acknowledge that even if, because it's the usual argument about corporations paying tax as a share of their profits, and that whether or not a corporation that is profitable should pay tax. And for the income tax, the minimum tax tries to acknowledge at some level that businesses are using state services, be they highways, the judicial, the courts, whatever those services are, that there should be a minimum contribution to the state coffers. There isn't anything magical per se about $500 or $1,000 or $50,000.
Okay. Well, good. All right. We'll continue this discussion in the form of other bills, I'm sure, if not this one again. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 150. All? We're good until tomorrow. So thank you. We are adjourned.